So this week we're coming to Genesis 12 to 14, where Abraham is tested. We have these three tests, and what are the three tests we come to? He's going to be tested with conflicts with kin, that's family members, if you're not from Kentucky, and kings. And so his tests are basically three tests. Number one is going to be famine, and that's real hunger. That's the famine where you starve to death. And then you're going to find in chapter 13, he's got family conflict, as if famine weren't bad enough. And then he's going to experience political conflict. And we'll see how that happens as we get into chapter 14. We already know from earlier chapters, chapter 11 and first part of 12, that Terah takes the whole family to Canaan. God comes to Abraham and Ur, gives him a great promise, probably the greatest promise in history. And Terah, his father, says, I believe that promise too, packs up the whole family. They go up to Haran. Well, Terah dies up there. At 75, Abraham takes all the people who have gone with him in the family, Lot included. And Terah kind of takes Lot under his wing because Lot's father died. Being Lot's uncle, he now kind of becomes his father. Well, Terah dies. So here's Lot, and Abraham takes over where Terah left off. So Abram at 75 packs up the family. He goes on to Canaan. And we saw this last time. He goes to Shechem, then he goes to Bethel. In both places, he builds an altar in the midst of wicked idolatry. And then he travels on down to the Negev, in the southern part of the land, which is on the edge of Egypt. He's done here is walk the full length of the land from kind of top to bottom. And Shechem's kind of the edge of Canaan. It's really the first major place you come to as you come into Canaan. And so he's walked down this whole thing. Now, Genesis 12:10 tells us that there is a famine. Now, again, this is not just, you know, people are missing a couple meals now and then, or maybe a couple of the McDonald's have closed due to shortage. This is people are starving to death. This is what it means to have a famine. Now, what causes a famine? Anybody know?
Lack of water.
That's generally the first cause. Now, there could be insects involved as well, but generally first cause in Israel is lack of water. Now, when you look at the land of Canaan, there really is no natural reservoir of water. It's a very dry land. You know the one way that Canaan gets its water? From rain. And they attributed that to being blessed by the gods. And in the Old Testament, God tells us that I'm going to withhold the rain and cause famine if you don't obey me. So rain comes from God. And it says, if you notice in verse 12, Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there because the famine was severe in the land. So there it is. That's the test. He goes down to Egypt. Now, how does Egypt get its water?
The Nile.
You know, famine in Egypt is rare. But what is common in Egypt is a flood. And that's a hardship. At this point, there's plenty of water down in Egypt. So there is no famine down in Egypt. So he goes down there. This is Abram's first test, and it's his first failure. And he wants to go down there to this Nile Valley where it's lush and green and there's lots of food. And he's just going to stay down there till the famine ends. Now, what he doesn't realize is that he's going to take a bad situation and turn it into a horrible situation. Because he's going to go down there, and when he gets there, he tells Sarah, he says, you tell everybody that you're my sister. I don't want you saying you're my wife, because if they think you're my wife, they're going to look at you, they're going to see you're beautiful, they're going to kill me, and they're going to take you to be the wife. So look at 12:13. Please say that you're my sister so that it may go well with me because of you, and then I may live on account of you. So he's kind of put himself into her hands. So he jeopardizes his blessing of promise. And when Pharaoh takes her, he's lost Sarah. And he's lost her to Pharaoh. If the story stopped right now, Abram's got this great promise from God, right? So you'd conclude, if the story were to stop, and the Bible would end right here, you'd go, well, Sarah must not be part of the promise. So somehow God's going to fulfill this promise, but he's going to do it apart from Sarah. But that isn't what's going to happen. Sarah is part of this promise. Sarah is his wife. And what do we learn from Genesis chapter 2? Two become one. So in God's eyes, they're one. Abraham and Sarah are one person. The Lord intervenes to save Abram and Sarah from this Egyptian bondage of the Pharaoh. It's Abraham's lack of faith that causes him to make the wrong decision. God's going to remember his promise. He's not going to forget what he told Abraham. Because Abraham makes a bad decision and ends up in a horrible situation where Sarah is taken by Pharaoh, God's going to work it out, so he's going to get his wife back, and they're going to be saved and rescued from Pharaoh. Now, that happens in 12:20. Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away. What's happened, he says, Pharaoh says, "Why did you lie to me? Why did you say she's your sister when she's your wife? If I'd have known she's your wife, I never would have taken her." You know what that tells you about Pharaoh? He's an honorable man. And you generally, as you study Egyptian religion and Egyptian culture and Egyptian society, they were an honorable people, especially when compared to the Canaanites, who were wicked, and the people who surrounded them knew they were wicked. But the Egyptians were an honorable people. They were a good people. So he says, you know, "Why did you lie to me? Why did you tell me this?" So he tells his men, "Get them out of here." But, you know, before he had done this, he had given Abram and Lot all these blessings, cattle and servants and money. You know, he didn't take any of it back. He says, "Just take your stuff and go," in verse 20. And they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. They didn't take the stuff away that he'd given him in verse 16. It says he treated Abraham well for her sake. So now in 13, they go back. And Abraham returns from Egypt with all this new wealth, and he settles near Bethel and Ai. And he and Lot have this great mass of wealth together. Now comes the second test. Now comes the family conflict. Now comes the problem. Look at 13:5-7. "Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, and the land could not sustain them while they dwelt together. For their possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together." I mean, this is telling you these are rich men. "And there was a strife between the herdsmen of Abraham's flock," and this is caused by prosperity. This is the effect of having too much money. Strife between Abraham's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen. So Abram, I think, has this sense of they're living among these people. They don't want this strife to continue. So Abram says to Lot, "Please, let there be no strife between you and me, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not this whole land before you? Separate from me, please. Let's part company. Let's part ways. If you choose this way, I'll go this way. You choose this way, I'll go this way." So he's saying to Lot, "Where do you want to go? What land do you want? Wherever you go, I'm going the opposite way." This is Abraham the elder not saying, "Look, you, I'm over you. You're going there, I'm going here." No, he gives Lot the choice. He's being very gracious. This is like the father letting the son choose and the father being gracious. Now, Lot looks around and they're up kind of high in Bethel and Ai, and he looks around. You know what he sees? He sees this valley down below. The best land is in the valley, and it's called the Valley of Fields. In Hebrew, it's called the Valley of Siddim. It's inhabited by wicked people, and it's a place not only rich in fields and green and lush, but it's a place of great cities. He sees that, and he goes, you know, that looks pretty good. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, it says in 12, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. He moved his tents to Sodom. That's an important distinction there in the text. He moved his tents toward Sodom, near Sodom. I want to point that out now. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, and exceedingly wicked, and sinners against the Lord. Now that Abram's alone now, Lot's gone, Terah's gone, he's completely separated from his past. If you think about what he told him back in Genesis 12, leave your homeland, leave your family, leave your relatives, and go to the land where I will show you. Well, now that's completely happened. And the Lord comes to him in verse 14 and reaffirms everything he told him back in chapter 12. And in verse 14, the Lord comes to Abraham after Lot had separated from him. That's an important little point. And said, now, Abraham, I want you to lift up your eyes. And he's up on a high hill. He said, I want you to lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are. Look north, south, east, and west for all the land which you see. As far as you can see, I will give it to your seed forever. And I will make your seed like the dust of the earth. Now, how many grains of dust are there on the earth? This is extreme hyperbole. But it's a hyperbole that's saying to Abraham, look, Abraham, you've got no children now, do you? In fact, you just jeopardized your wife and almost lost her. You still have no children, but your children are going to be like the dust of the earth. So that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can be numbered. If you can number all the grains of sand on the ocean beach, then they'll be able to number your children. But see, that's impossible. Because your children will not be able to be numbered. He says, you get up, you walk through the land, through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. Notice the reiteration of this promise that he started back in chapter 12. Now in chapter 12, he's saying, if you get up and if you go, I will give that land to you. But notice now that he's completely separated and completely alone, God comes and really reinforces what he's going to do. This is a promise to give the land to Abraham and his descendants, and this cannot be rescinded. Now Lot, so Abraham maybe had in his mind that maybe Lot is going to be my heir. No. Even though Abraham has taken him and cared for him since Terah died, Lot is not his heir. He has no children, but he's going to have them. So just to go back, your heir will be your son. Guaranteed. This land is yours forever. Your children will be like the dust of the earth. That's the promise to Abraham. So Lot settles in Sodom, the beautiful green valley, and Abram stays and settles in Hebron. Hebron is not lush, beautiful, and green. Hebron is high, rugged country. But 13:18 says that Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre. Now Mamre is a person. Mamre is a family head, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. This is the third altar he's built. Now the oaks are places of idolatrous worship, because later on in the Old Testament, this is what God will call these places of idolatry on the hilltops. You start to see this get introduced in early in Genesis. These are places where the Canaanites worship their gods. Abram comes and builds an altar right there next to him, proclaiming the true God. Proclaiming the true God in the midst of wickedness. And this is the third time he's done that. So, there's test number two. Seems to be going pretty well. He resolves that diplomatically, and God comes and blesses him as a result. Now the third test. This is political. This has worldwide implications. This involves politics and family honor. This is the great rebellion of the Western kings. The kings of Shinar, who are these four kings, they rule everything. They rule the entire Mesopotamian Valley, the entire Fertile Crescent. These are the main kings. And they ruled over the Western kings because these guys, here are their names. There's five of them, only four of them are named. One is just called the King of Bela. These guys have to pay taxes and tribute back to these guys. If they don't pay this kickback, if they don't pay a portion of their wealth back to those kings in the east, the kings in the east consider that to be a rebellion. 14:4 clarifies the issue. 12 years they had served Kedor Laomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. Who's the they? The they are the kings of the west. Rebelled against Kedor Laomer. He's the king of Elam. That region is controlling the region of the west. Since they rebel against them, that means war. That means that these rebels must be brought back into line. This is a little bit like if you've ever seen a movie or read a story about the mafia. The mafia godfather collects tribute from all the soldiers that are under him. So all the people that they steal from and they cheat and that they rob and they take their businesses and they take their money, All of those soldiers take that money and they take a piece of it and kick it up to the capo, the captain of the family. The capo takes part of that money and kicks it up to the godfather. Now, what if a soldier decides, I'm not going to pay my tribute to the capo? They kill him. Why? Didn't do what he was supposed to do, so that's a retaliation. It also sends a great message to anyone else who's thinking the same thing. And sometimes they'll punish not only that one capo, but all the soldiers that work for him. What the kings of the West do, they're supposed to collect taxes and collect money and collect tribute from the people who live under them, and then they're supposed to take a piece of that and kick it back to the kings of the East. Wars are fought in this time for retaliation, punishment, and revenge. So what they do, they decide, okay, you've done this, we're going to have to take action. They travel up to the top of the crescent, and they're going to come down from the north, and they're going to retaliate. And the red line is the line of retaliation. They come down through Damascus. They're traveling down what's called the Highway of Kings, and they're going to break things and take things all the way down. They go all the way down to what we call the Persian Gulf, by the way. This is the city of Eilat, the modern city of Eilat, a beach resort in Israel. Beautiful place. They go all the way down there, and they go back up through Kadesh Barnea, and where do they end up? They end up in Sodom. That's really where they're headed. But you know, they've come all the way over here, and they're going to create havoc with all the people in this valley because of what these five kings had decided to do. So what they're doing is they're punishing everybody for what these five kings did. And they come up and they have this great battle in Zor with these five kings, and they completely beat them. They run for the hills. Their armies are decimated. That's the battle of chapter 14. So these four kings come with their armies, and they completely decimate the armies of these five kings. Now what they do from this point is they make a mistake. The only mistake they make, I mean, they're doing great. They got victory. What they do is they take Lot and all his stuff, and they head on back. Now, Abram hears about this through one of the survivors of the battle down in the valley. He hears about this, and he's not going to let them get away with that. So what they've done by taking Lot is they've turned a great success into a humiliating defeat, and they don't realize it yet. Because they're on their way back to Damascus, and they're going to go on back down with all this stuff that they've taken, and they're going to go back down proclaiming victory. If you look at 14, 11, and 12, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and their food supply and departed. And they took also Lot, Abraham's nephew, and his possessions, and they departed. Here's a very telling line. For he was living where? In. Different preposition that we had before. I said, remember I said I make a point of this. He first moved near Sodom. Where is he now?
In.
He's in Sodom. He has immersed himself in this wicked culture. Now let me ask you, if you had a relative like this and you watched him make these choices and he ends up in the midst of this wickedness and he gets taken in this war that the kings of Sodom started, and he gets taken captive with all his stuff, what's your first reaction?
He
got what he deserved. He made his bed, let him lie in it. Right? Don't we say that?
Yeah.
Huh? So he gets taken. What am I supposed to do about it? Abraham doesn't take it that way. They've taken Lot? No, they're not going to get away with that. I don't care how badly he's messed up his life. Whether he's in the midst of this wicked culture and he's immersed in it, I don't care. If they took my relative, I'm going to get him back. And so Abraham is going to retaliate in his own way. But you know the problem he has? He's not a king. He's a farmer. He gets the best people he can get, 300 guys, who are Canaanite friends from the friends that he's made around Hebron, 300 guys, and they take off and they go after these kings. They go up the valley. They're a few days behind them. They catch them up in Dan, and these 300 men at night, they attack, and they win. Now, can you believe that? He chases the armies of these kings, 300 men, four powerful kings, and they get beat by this little tiny force. Talk about humiliation. I mean, they're planning on going back, proclaiming victory. And had they not taken Lot, would Abraham have done this? He would have had no reason to go after them. He had no political involvement in this war. He's a farmer up in the hills of Hebron. He probably had paid tribute because everybody that lives under these kings has to pay something. But he's got no skin in this game until they take Lot. The victory with 300 men that the five kings of Sodom with their armies couldn't have. They had just won a war down in the valley of Siddim against five kings and their army. So this isn't just some wimpy force. This is a force that got defeated by the power of God. Now, so Abraham goes home. See, the blue line goes up there to Dan, then goes to Damascus. They chase him out of Dan. They chase him as far as Damascus, and Abraham says, that's enough, let him go. They're going to go back home, and people are going to say, what happened? What happened? Great victory, great victory. Well, it kind of was, until we got to Dan on our way back home, and this guy came and beat us up and took all our stuff back. So he comes back with not only the stuff that they took from Lot, but he comes back with all the other stuff that they'd taken out of Sodom. And he brings it back down and he stops in a place called Salem or Salem. And he stops in this place called Salem and he gets a blessing from a guy named Melchizedek. And that's in verse 18. Melchizedek, the king of Salem, king of Salem now, this king that's not involved in the war, by the way, brought out bread and wine, which is kind of the normal meal that you would bring out to honor someone. He was a priest of the Most High God. Not only is he a king, he's a priest. And he blessed Abraham. And he said, blessed be Abraham of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who's delivered your enemies into your hand. So he's acknowledging this great victory isn't because of Abraham and his 300 men, it's because of the great Most High God. So this priest serves the same God that Abraham serves. So he's not an idolatrous priest. He's not like the priests of the Canaanites. He's different. What happens here now is Bera, who's the king of Sodom, comes to Salem as well. Because obviously the news is that Abraham has won the battle. He's coming back. So Bera, he wants to come out to greet him as well. And so Bera, this king, he comes out and he sees that Abraham has been blessed by this lesser king, priest king in Salem, who really wasn't part of this coalition in this battle, but he gets blessed by this Melchizedek. And then Abram takes some of the stuff that he got in the battle, and he pays a tithe or a tribute to Melchizedek. So he's paying a tithe and a tribute to this lesser king from the spoils of the battle. Now, Bera's standing here watching this, knowing that a person only pays tithes to someone he considers a superior. Because you don't pay taxes to someone below you, you pay taxes to someone above you. So the leading king of the valley, who was Bera of Sodom, because Sodom is the major city in the valley, he would assume that he deserves the tribute, the tithe. He's coming forth as the main king. The fact that he's able to survive this battle at all is kind of a mystery. But he's still assuming authority in this valley. And he doesn't take a tithe. What he does, Bera offers to give Abraham everything he took from the battle. It's kind of a counter offer. So it says in verse 21, the king of Sodom, standing there watching this interaction between Abraham and Melchizedek, says, give the people to me and take the goods for yourself. I mean, give my people back to me. But you can keep all the stuff. And Abraham says to the king of Sodom, I've sworn to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth. Verse 22. I've sworn to him that I will not take a thread or a sandal, thong, or anything that's yours, lest you should say I've made Abraham rich. I'm only going to take what I need to pay the men who went into battle with me. The rest of it I don't want. You can have it. So Abraham turns him down. Here's a king, a powerful king, standing in front of a lesser king, offering Abraham all this tribute. So look, you take it. Saying, look, I'm making you a counter offer that's certainly a better blessing than just a meal. I mean, he brought a meal out to you. I'm offering you something far greater. Abraham says, no thank you, sir. But he doesn't just say, no thank you, sir. He says it with an insult. And what he's saying when he turns him down, he says, you know, I don't serve you. I will take nothing from you. And what's implied is because I don't honor you and I'm not going to take anything from you, I'm not going to give you anything as future tribute either. I'm not paying my taxes to you. I serve that king in Salem. Think of how different Abraham is here from what he was back 12 in Egypt when he went down there. He's not the kind of coward here that he was in Egypt. He's willing to insult this powerful king of the valley because he believes God will protect him. The real political test is not the battle to rescue Lot. That was more family loyalty and kind of retaliation for taking my relative. The real test is that he will not align himself with the wickedness of Sodom. That's the real test, even though Lot has done that. Because Lot moved right back into Sodom again. But see, Abraham standing up says, I'm not aligning myself with Sodom. I'm aligning myself with Salem. Now, what does Salem later on become? Jerusalem. The word city in Hebrew is Yeru. So it becomes Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Now, once Abraham gets alone again, now this is important. This is important to see. We're going to close right here because this happens to all of us. Once Abraham gets alone again and thinks about what he's done, he wavers. He's afraid. You ever notice how we do that? We make a decision that seems totally faithful and righteous in the light of day. And then what happens at 3 o'clock in the morning when you wake up in a cold sweat? The hour of gloom and doubt and fear. And you start to second guess your decision. And we become afraid. He knows he's exposed himself to retaliation. He has just insulted the most powerful king in the valley. So look at 15:1. Notice how 15:1 starts. After these things. After what things? All the things we just read about in 12, 13, and 14. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision and said what? He says, don't be afraid. I am a shield to you, and your reward will be very great. What I want you to see right here is the Lord comes to Abraham in the loneliness of the night. This is nighttime. Abraham's afraid. God comes and says, look, I'm your shield. What's a shield? Yeah, so it's an implement of war. And God said, you don't have to worry about these kings. You don't have to worry about that war you just got involved in. You don't have to think about that. I'm your shield. I'm your protection. I'm protecting you. Didn't you just win a battle with 300 men? How do you think that happened? You know what Melchizedek said to you. It's because of the Most High God. I'm your reward. I'm your provider. So God is the protector and the provider. You know what? If he's that for Abraham, he's that for us. We do not need the world's favor. We do not need the world to look down and smile on us and say, oh, aren't you wonderful people? We don't need that. We don't need their protection. We don't need their provision. We can say to them, I'm not taking anything from you because my riches aren't from you. They're from Jesus Christ. And I have all the riches that God provided in him. I don't need yours. I don't need your religions. I don't need your politics. I don't need your money. I don't need your wealth. I don't need your security. I have the Lord. If something doesn't go just right, do we doubt that? Absolutely. When we have a kind of a famine in our lives, do we doubt that? Yeah. Do we make dumb decisions because we get afraid? Yes. Like Abraham, Abraham's fears brought about dishonesty and doubt. Now, many times, you know, in our lives, if we do have a great victory in life over someone or something, sometimes the next thing that happens is we go down. It's almost like God saying, you know, I don't want you to stay up here in this mountain too long. You still have to learn that you're really, I'm everything and you're nothing kind of thing. But Abraham's faith brought victory and assurance. Victory, not only within his family with Lot. He lets Lot make his own choices, and I'm sure it broke his heart to see what Lot did. But he let Lot make his own choice, but came to his rescue, had victory, not only in his family, but over these other kings. And then God brought him assurance. Look, I'm your shield. I'm your reward. When it seems like a lack of faith threatens the Lord's blessing, you know, we find out the Lord is faithful in spite of our lack of faith, in spite of our doubt, in spite of our bad decisions, in spite of our sin. The Lord is still faithful. When you get afraid, you do dumb things. When you get afraid, instead of doing something dumb, back off, pray, and wait. Isn't that what the Bible tells us to do? Next time we're going to Genesis 15 to 17. And let me give you a tip. Read ahead. Read from 15 to 17. Read ahead. Kind of get a handle on some of the details that are there. We're going to look at the Abrahamic covenant, a blood covenant. And he's going to give him a covenant sign that he can hang on to, and his family and his nation can hang on to. And that's where we're going next time. Okay?